This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Okay, so your research is into the cosmic microwave background, right?
That's right.
Give us a bit of a backgrounder on the cosmic microwave background. What is it?
The cosmic microwave background is really the oldest light that we can observe in the universe. We believe that this radiation is produced at very, very early times, basically when the light nuclei formed in the universe. And our best evidence for this is that it has a spectrum, so a dependence on frequency or wavelength of the radiation, which is very well described by what's called a black body spectrum. Mm. So this is the same sort of spectrum as you would get if you had a hot object like the sun, for example. Whereas the surface of the sun is at a few thousand Kelvin, the microwave background is only at a few Kelvin, 2.7 Kelvin. So the interpretation of this is that it was produced when the universe was very dense and very hot at a very early time. Everything has this nice black body spectrum, and then the expanding universe has cooled that radiation. It's stretched out the wavelength of all the radiation, and we end up with radiation at a much lower temperature, which is what we observe today. So the microwave background was first discovered at the end of the 1960s, and since then, the interest has really been to look for fluctuations in the temperature of that radiation. And the fluctuations are essentially imprinted by clumping in the way matter is distributed in the universe at early times.
When we talk about fluctuations in the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, we're talking about fluctuations in space, aren't we, in position rather than in time.
That's right. So all we can really do at the moment is look at different directions on the sky and see how the temperature in one direction compares to another. It is a very interesting issue about what the time dependence of those fluctuations would be. But basically, as with everything in cosmology, things evolve on a very, very slow time scale. Mm. So billions of years, basically. So if we waited long enough, things would look different in time.
But to us, we just see a snapshot of
what
the... Right. And the thing with the... When you have a hot object and you suddenly make it bigger, which you can do in terms of how we think the universe expanded, then the temperature goes down because you've just expanded it. Wouldn't we expect, you know, what do we learn from what we see in these fluctuations? So you'd think that something which was very, very hot and you suddenly expanded it, it should be roughly the same temperature, right, everywhere you looked.
Right, so the point is that the temperature it's very nearly the same in all directions, but it's not quite. And those fluctuations are really small. They're at the level of about one part in 10 to the 5. Mm-hmm. And what these fluctuations are telling us about is basically the way, as I said, matter is clumped at a time when the universe was about a thousandth of its current size. So the way to think about this is say in some region of space you have an over-density of matter. So locally you have more matter than you do on average. Then as the microwave background radiation climbs away from that local blob of matter to reach us today, it's sort of climbing out of a gravitational potential well due to the matter. And due to general relativistic effects, so effects predicted by Einstein, what happens is that the wavelength of the radiation receives an extra stretching due to that climbing out of a potential well. And hence the radiation appears a little bit colder than it would otherwise. So on sort of large scales, so scales of a few degrees on the sky, if we see a blob in the temperature of the microwave background of that sort of scale that's colder than average, then that corresponds to a region in space when the universe was much smaller, which is more dense than average.
Okay, so there's interesting things coming out of this. First of all, you're measuring temperature differences one part in 100,000. Is that in real terms? Is that 100,000th of a Kelvin? Is that the difference in temperature that you're measuring?
That's right. So it's 100,000th of about 3 Kelvin.
That's remarkable.
So it requires remarkable technology to be able to do this. Yeah. And it's actually why the search for these fluctuations in temperature went on for a long time before anyone actually found anything. So the microwave background was first discovered, as I said, the middle of the 1960s, and it took until 1992 before these primordial fluctuations were actually detected. And even then, to detect them, people had to basically go out, well, people didn't, but they had to launch instruments out into space to be able to get away from things like the Earth's atmosphere, which glows very brightly and disturbs your measurements.
The measurements that had been taken prior to 1992, they showed pretty much what we expected, right? What I mentioned earlier was that everything seemed to be very, very flat in temperature distribution. It seemed to be what you'd expect if you took a regular object and expanded it. The temperature went down very, very evenly. But what happened in 1992 that was so exciting?
Okay, so, I mean, theorists for a long time had been predicting that there ought to be these fluctuations in temperature. And actually the field was sort of reaching crisis point where the theorists had been able to revise their models to sort of keep in line with the data. So the observationalists weren't seeing anything, so the theorists tweaked their theory a little bit. But things had got about as far as they could, so there basically wasn't any room for manoeuvre anymore. And if these fluctuations hadn't been detected, then basically our understanding of the way that matter evolves in the universe must have been fundamentally wrong. Fortunately, the fluctuations came at just the level that was being predicted at the time. So this was a sort of saving grace for our whole paradigm for how structure formed in the universe.
How were these fluctuations detected back in the early 90s?
So they were first detected by the COBE satellite, the Cosmic Background Explorer, and a particular instrument on that called the Differential Microwave Radiometer. And essentially it worked by performing what's called a differential measurement, which is a very good way of measuring. If you're trying to measure small differences in quantities, it's often easier, instead of trying to measure an absolute value, you measure a difference relative to some reference load. So essentially this is how the DMR instrument functioned. But essentially the technology was basically radio technology, so quite what is now old-fashioned technology.
So we should point out, of course, that it's a cosmic microwave background, so we observe in microwaves.
That's right, yeah. So these are frequencies of a few tens of gigahertz.
Let's go back to what you said earlier before, that the cosmic microwave background basically shows us where the matter was when the radiation was released, when the universe was 1,000th of its size. It shows where the matter in the universe was. But how did the matter get there in the first place? What told the matter to clump in that particular way, in those particular regions?
So I mean, this is a sort of very outstanding question in cosmology at the moment. We'd like to understand. But what we believed happened was that in the very, very early universe, when the temperature of the universe was very, very high and matter was very, very dense, what we believed happened is that quantum processes were occurring on very small length scales, but they got stretched up by a process called cosmological inflation up to very large cosmological scales. So these quantum fluctuations are the same quantum fluctuations that are present all around us at the moment. So what we think of as the vacuum is actually a very interesting quantum mix of all sorts of activity going on. And there are, you know, virtual particles popping out of the vacuum all the time and then annihilating. And similar things were happening in the infant universe. But the thing that was different then was because of this very rapid expansion that we believe happened because of a particular form of matter that's posited to be present in the early universe, those fluctuations got stretched into essentially classical fluctuations. And what we then believe happened was that the matter that was, this strange matter that was causing the universe to undergo this cosmological inflation, this accelerated expansion, it then decayed into all the particles and the radiation that we now see around us. But during that decay, there was an imprint of how that inflationary matter was actually distributed because of these quantum fluctuations. So what we really believe we're seeing is quantum effects writ very, very large on the sky.
When we talk about very, very large, what sort of size are what are the sizes of these structures that we're talking about which were seeded by quantum fluctuations?
So if we think about the sort of scale of the observable universe, if we think about how far we can actually look back in time, it corresponds to about 10 billion light years. And basically we're probing the way matter is distributed on that sort of scale. The only thing we have to be a little bit careful of is to factor in the expansion of in the universe in all this. So those fluctuations today would have that scale, whereas when we run them back in time to the time when the fluctuations in the microwave background were produced, everything was a factor of a thousand smaller.
So the presence of these structures, these large-scale structures that we see in the universe, strings of galaxies and clumps of galaxies, back when the universe was very, very young, could have been simply the difference between a tiny quantum fluctuation one way or the other.
That's absolutely right. So, I mean, of course, if we look at the way galaxies, for example, are distributed today, things don't look at all smooth. Things are, you know, what we call very, very non-linear. Whereas when we look at the microwave background, the fluctuations are very smooth. They're sort of one part in 100,000, as you said. And the reason for that is basically the fact that if you have a blob of matter, which is so where there's more matter than the average in the universe, what it will tend to do is accrete surrounding matter. So these fluctuations in the matter actually grow via a process of gravitational accretion, just attracting other matter. And this is what we believe happens. So these fluctuations started off very small. So the primordial level was at the sort of level of one part in 100,000. But because of accreting surrounding matter, it grew up to give us very large-scale fluctuations that we now see in the large-scale structure of the universe.
This was always a problem with our understanding of the Big Bang cosmology, as I understand it. If you take a lot of energy, like the energy of the entire universe, and cram it into a very, very small point, the singularity as we understand it, which we call the Big Bang, and then let it expand. The problem was that if you had all that energy in one small spot, it was very, very, very hot, and therefore presumably very, very smooth. You couldn't have some little parts of that tiny volume with all that energy comprised together being slightly higher than the other, because it would all just be smoothed out. It would be thermally smoothed out and become very, very homogeneous. So in order to produce these large clumpiness, this large-scale structure, this clumpiness that we see in the universe, we needed something different. We need some kind of difference between one point in the early universe and another. And so we had to appeal to physics, and it's these quantum fluctuations. Tell us a little bit about these quantum fluctuations themselves, and what are they?
Well,
first of all, have I got that right? I just made a statement. I didn't actually ask a question.
That is basically true. So, the most important advance here really was this idea of inflation, cosmological inflation in the early universe. So perhaps I should say a bit more about that first of all. The problem is that normally we would expect matter gravitationally to attract other matter. So if you throw a ball up in the air, while it's rising up, it slows down, eventually turns around and comes back to us. And the universe should actually be acting in the same way. So the universe is expanding, we know it is, but because of the attraction of all the matter in the universe, it ought to be slowing down in its expansion. In the early universe, we believe that because of the presence of a strange kind of matter, which was effectively almost repulsive gravitationally, it had a large pressure, which could, the effect of this pressure was to basically change the gravitational attraction into a gravitational repulsion. And the effect of that is that this expanding object, instead of attracting itself, it effectively tried to blow itself apart. So the effect of this is that a very, very small region of space, which is originally so small that everything had time to communicate with itself, it's what we see to be in causal contact with itself, that very small region can be blown up by an enormous amount, something like 10 to the 50 or so in size.
10 to the 50, that's crazy. That's one with 50 zeros.
That's one with 50 zeros, an absolutely enormous amount. It can get blown up basically to encompass our entire observable universe. This is why we think that the microwave background is basically so smooth when we look at it. If this period of inflation, cosmological inflation, hadn't happened in the early universe, it would have been a real mystery why, when we look at different regions of the sky, why the temperature is so uniform. So we actually needed inflation to understand that very basic property that the universe is so smooth on large scales.
And simply by multiplying a very, very small effect, these quantum effects, these quantum processes, which we know operate at very, very low energies, very, very small energies and very, very low scales, by something like 10 to the 50, we can get something very, very small becoming something very, very big.
At least
noticeable, so that, you know, things like gravitational accretion can occur on reasonable time.
That's right. So, there's two aspects. The 10 to the 50 refers to the sort of length scale of these fluctuations, so they get stretched out. But the other thing is that they can be amplified in, their amplitude can get larger as well. And this happens in a very specific time during inflation. So basically, as modes get stretched out during the cosmological inflation, the quantum character is basically replaced by, once they get stretched to a certain critical length scale, they become essentially classical in character. And they have an amplitude, which is just basically determined by the rate at which the universe is expanding at that time. So that's what's setting the basic amplitude of the fluctuations. And then later on, as matter accretes due to gravity, the amplitude can get boosted further.
Hmm. When we look at the sky, when we talk about the sky, we're talking about the entire sky that we can see. With our satellites, we see these fluctuations. What do we actually measure? We measure the differential temperature, but we're talking about fluctuations at various scales. So we want to measure small fluctuations and then slightly bigger fluctuations and even bigger fluctuations. So what is it that we actually measure? What is the data that we receive that we use to make these predictions about the universe?
So the way these experiments work is basically by they scan across the sky to produce a survey of the full sky. So at any time, what you're basically measuring is the temperature along a single direction. And then as time goes by, the instrument repoints to a different direction and then measures the temperature somewhere else. And then there's a whole load of data analysis steps that have to go on to try and convert that data, which is essentially a time series, to convert that into first of all, a map of what the temperature looks like on the sky, and then try and extract various statistical properties of that map. The easiest way actually to confront the data with our theoretical models is to ask what is the sort of amplitude of the fluctuations in temperature as a function of angular scale.
Mm.
And we do this basically by looking for blobs within the temperature at a fixed angular scale and ask what's the amplitude of those.
When we talk about amplitude, do we mean how many there are or how strong they are?
Sorry, how strong they are.
Right.
That's right.
How deep the temperature difference is, essentially, how, you know.
That's right. And what we basically find is a very interesting dependence on the strength of the fluctuation with angular scale. And in particular, we find a sort of oscillatory character whereby certain angular scales seem to have much more power than other angular scales. And this is reflecting also something very interesting that happened in the early universe. It's basically reflecting the acoustic physics of how the primordial plasma, so the stuff that made up the universe, when the temperature was greater than a few thousand degrees, it's reflecting the dynamics of that plasma. So effectively, this is like doing acoustic physics. It's the physics of sound waves bouncing around, but these are sound waves on cosmological scales.
Mm.
And so these huge wavelengths. And what we're basically doing when we look at the fluctuation amplitude as a function of scale, we're measuring the amplitude of these sound waves with different wavelengths.
So these are sound waves in the primordial plasma when the universe was very, very young, soon after the universe came into being. We should point out, of course, that when we talk about acoustic in this sense, we're talking about longitudinal waves in a medium. Because we all know that we can't, you know, sound doesn't travel in a pure vacuum. But we're not talking about a pure vacuum here. We're talking about this very hot, energized plasma when the universe was very, very young. So we have these sort of sound waves which are bouncing around in the primordial plasma of the universe, and that somehow gets imprinted on how strong a particular sized CMB fluctuation is. What does that tell us?
That's right. So, I mean, one way to think about this, imagine waves on a violin string, for example. These are what are called standing waves. So the whole string sort of vibrates in unison. And at certain points, the string is undisturbed, whereas a little bit later in time, it's at maximum displacement. And the time period between when it goes from zero displacement to maximum displacement depends on the frequency of the wave, or equivalently the wavelength of the standing wave. So the same thing goes on in the primordial plasma, in that fluctuations on different angular scales will vibrate in an acoustic manner on different time scales. So what's happening is that at the time when basically the fluctuations in the microwave background are imprinted on the sky. And this, I should have said, this occurs basically when the universe stops being very opaque and very ionized. As the temperature cools, basically neutral atoms form and the radiation stops interacting with matter. It travels unimpeded, and that's what we see in the microwave.
The universe becomes transparent.
The universe becomes transparent, that's right. So what we see is conditions at that time when it just became transparent. And the fluctuations on different length scales, which are bouncing Earth sound waves with different frequencies, at the time the universe became transparent, some of those sound waves are just caught at their maximum displacement, and some are just caught at zero displacement.
Mm.
So those that are caught at maximum displacement give us features, angular features on the microwave background sky, which are maximal in amplitude. Whereas those that are caught at zero displacement basically give no fluctuation on that particular scale. So what we can really read off from that is something about both the composition of the universe, so how much matter there is, how much of the ordinary matter, so the stuff that we're made of, basically atoms, and how much of this mysterious dark matter that we know must be present, basically to keep galaxies bound together. We can, for example, measure the relative proportions of those. But we can also say something about the sort of global geometry of the universe. So remember, we're talking about these sound waves, which have a spatial wavelength associated with them. But what we see on the microwave sky is an angular wavelength, if you like. And the relation between those depends basically on what we call the angular diameter distance back to when the universe became transparent. So that's one of the key things we can actually measure from the microwave background fluctuations, this angular diameter distance, which is telling us something about the geometry of the universe. Just to put a bit more on that, if the universe were, for example, if the geometry were sort of Euclidean, like the simple geometry that we learn at school, then there's a very simple parallel straight lines remain parallel and never converge onto each other. Sound waves of a given wavelength in the primordial plasma will appear with a very characteristic angular scale on the sky today. But if instead, say we curved the universe up, so it was like the three-dimensional analogue of the surface of a sphere, then what we find is that light rays tend to sort of converge together and there's a focusing effect. And what that does, it tends to make fluctuations on the microwave sky look larger in angular scale than they would do in a Euclidean universe. The thing is, theorists can predict rather accurately what physical size these sound waves ought to have in the early universe. And then you can read off from looking at their angular size, you can read off what the geometry of the universe is.
It's a remarkable amount of information you can get by looking at just essentially a two-dimensional map of the cosmic microwave background, just measuring, you know, how strong fluctuations of various sizes are. It's a phenomenal amount of physics which you learn from this.
That's right. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the microwave background really has revolutionized our understanding of the cosmos. And, okay, there's been a lot of complementary data sets that have been helping out to do this, but the microwave background is such a nice, clean probe of the earliest times in the universe that it really has been invaluable in this quest to try and understand the properties of the universe.
What's next?
Well, so for microwave background research, one very exciting thing that's going to happen is a new satellite is going to be launched. So this is a European satellite called the Planck satellite, hopefully going to be launched later towards the end of this year. And compared to current observations, this will measure fluctuations on much smaller angular scales and with much better precision. So really what we hope to do with Planck is to map out these fluctuations in temperature very, very accurately, and basically extract all of the cosmological information that is present in the temperature of the microwave background. So this is a very exciting prospect, and, for example, will improve our understanding of what the universe is made of and what its geometry. We hope to understand that at the sort of percent level after the Planck data is analysed.
Fantastic. We can't wait. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome.